Welcome to Citizens Climate Radio. In this show, we highlight people's stories. We celebrate your successes, and together we share strategies for talking about climate change. I'm your host, Peter Santoscano. Welcome to episode 64 of Citizens Climate Radio, a project of Citizens Climate Education. This episode is airing on Friday, September 24th, 2021. In the Art House, we introduce you to the ultimate Cli-Fi book club. Krista Heiser lets her imagination run wild as she reflects on climate fiction novels. We also have a good news story from Yale Climate Connections. We learn about a new fund which aims to bring more people into the climate conversation. But first, I want to introduce you to a Hindu American who brings his whole self to the climate change conversation. I met Hari Venkatachalam earlier this year. We were part of a virtual interfaith panel that was sponsored by the Interreligious Eco-Justice Network, the Hartford Seminary, and Connecticut Interfaith Power and Light. His approach to climate change is both personal and professional. Hari Venkatachalam connects his faith, work, heritage, and even his sexual orientation to his leadership in a climate-changed world.
I'm a Hindu by birth. My family came to the United States in 1980. That's when my father migrated to the United States. In many ways, they very much embraced becoming American. My father still identifies very culturally with his background as Indian, but he's very proud of his nationality as an American. The way he blended these worlds was through his faith. He felt that there is a very genuine American Hindu identity, that one could be Hindu and American. And the way he wanted to apply that is that he would take these values, these cultural norms that he associated with Hinduism, that also were linked to the Indian cultural aspect, and try to find what would they be like in this new space. Have you ever read the book American Gods by Neil Gaiman? It's a very good book. It's about, you know, migrants bringing their faith and their gods with them to come to the United States and how these gods work in the new world. So my dad raised me with these values as a Hindu, and he says, okay, these are these timeless values that were created in South Asia thousands of years ago. How are you going to apply them every day as an American?
Hari has been faithful to his father's teaching and has found beautiful and profound ways to apply these values towards making the world a better place for all.
I'm part of an organization called Sadhana Coalition of Progressive Hindus. I'm one of the board members. It's a relatively new organization. It's been only around for about 10, 11 years, which in the grand scheme of a lot of organizations is kind of short. But they've done a lot of great work. There's a lot of various issues that we're working on right now, combating casteism in our communities, Islamophobia in our communities, and also like other issues that we deal with as Americans, you know, LGBTQ plus issues, environmentalism issues. My advocacy is predominantly in working on environmental issues and specifically LGBTQ plus issues, because I identify as gay or queer.
In addition to the many ways his faith and personal identity inform and influence his service in the world, his profession gives him a keen insight into how climate change impacts all of our lives, especially people living on the margins of society.
My background is in public health. I got my master's in public health. I'm a data analyst for the Veterans Health Administration. A large part of what I do, my daily work, is public health work with veterans. Specifically, my research focus is PTSD, pain management, traumatic brain injury. And also, we do a lot of whole health stuff, how yoga impacts pain management, how Tai Chi impacts PTSD symptom relief. We're very much about like holistic health right now. The way I've always seen it is with climate change, with the destruction of our environment, with pollution, any of these kind of negative things that are happening in our environment, it's a gradual progression up the scale of who gets affected, right? The people who are in the most stable conditions, economically, socially, politically, they're going to be the last ones to be affected by such changes. And that's why the reaction towards climate change is the way it is a lot of people, just because of the circumstances of their lives, they don't see the daily effect of pollution or environmental destruction. It's always going to be the most vulnerable people that are first going to see the impact of global warming, rising sea levels. I mean, we're starting to see that even along the Gulf Coast in the United States. Poor, predominantly African-American communities are affected first by rising sea levels over other Americans.
Hadi and I both share a specific concern about a group of young people often others do not realize are disproportionately affected by the impacts of climate change.
As a gay or queer person, there are certain vulnerabilities that we experience. Gay and queer youth are the most likely to be affected by homelessness, for example.
In fact, up to 40% of youth living on the streets in the United States and Canada are lesbian, gay, bisexual, transgender, and non-binary. More and more, the term queer, which had been long used as a slur, has been adopted by younger LGBTQ people to describe themselves. These queer youth find conditions in their communities, their schools, and even their homes so hostile, they move to the streets of cities throughout North America. Living on the streets comes with many risks for everyone, especially youth. Queer youth face even greater challenges. Many of them avoid going to shelters because they assume they will receive the same discrimination and hostility they escaped. This is especially true for transgender and gender non-binary young people. This puts them at extra risk during extreme weather events.
Let's do like kind of a flow of where that happens. If you're an LGBTQ person, you're more likely to be homeless. If you're more likely to be homeless, you're more likely to be affected by these deep freezes that are happening throughout the United States due to the polar vortex. Global warming is causing these polar vortexes to migrate further and further south. So then are you more likely as a LGBTQ person to be affected by injury or death due to these deep freezes that might be occurring? The more vulnerable you are, the more likely you're to be impacted by these environmental changes.
Extreme weather of all sorts, including storms and flooding, impact everyone in a city, but not equally. Kathy Boffman McLeod is the director of the Adrian Arsht Rockefeller Foundation Resilience Center. She writes about extreme weather and often points out that extreme heat is the silent killer. In the U.S., it is the single largest cause of death brought on by natural disasters.
Elderly and youth are at great risk of heat and death from heat in the U.S. and everywhere. Homeless populations have been shown to be extremely vulnerable to heat, particularly in the South and the Southwest. There's a remarkable long article by Jeff Goodell in Rolling Stone specifically about homeless populations in Phoenix, Arizona. And it's just indicative of other communities where populations are exposed to heat. And we so often think about protecting homeless people from the cold. As I said, it sneaks up quietly. And so there is a growing concern over death and sickness in the homeless populations.
In an upcoming episode, Kathy Boffman McLeod will tell us about the many ways cities are adapting and protecting citizens. Supporting the work of homeless shelters and homeless shelters that specifically cater to queer youth is one of many ways you can act locally to strengthen your community. Hari Venkatachalam comes to his climate work with a curious mind. As a politically left-leaning person coming to climate work with a global perspective, he seeks to deepen the conversation.
Sometimes what we do in left spaces that I worry about is we create these ideas of good and bad, right? People are good because they're doing environmental work. People are bad because they oppose environmental work. But I think people are a lot more complex than that. Let's look at the context of the Indian subcontinent, where a majority of the world's Hindus live. If you go to certain parts of South India, there's right now a huge issue of logging in state parks, in forests, in jungles. But when you go and talk to these individuals who are sneaking into these national parks and cutting down trees, they're not doing it to be malicious, right? A lot of times they're doing it because there is an economic need. They need that wood to either fuel what they're doing at home or to sell it to provide food for their family. I would seek that we change the conversation from being, we are doing environmental work, so we're the good guys, to how do we get it that we can empathize with everyone's needs, but still accomplish our goals? How can we listen to people who are afraid of what might happen to their company if certain environmental restrictions are put into place? What do we do if somebody comes to us and says, I'm having difficulty building affordable housing in a part of California because there's so many environmental restrictions? How can we still accomplish our goals without just demonizing a group of people, but hearing what they have to say, bringing them to the table, and still accomplishing our goals? That's a conversation that just isn't happening. It's disappointing because when you keep people away from the table, you lose momentum for your goal. There's people who are opposing you. There's people who are going to be breaks to your mission. And I'm saying, let's open it up. Let's put all of our feet to the gas pedal, start accomplishing really good work in promoting environmentalism, stopping global warming, but listening to everyone and hearing everyone's needs. Talking about right now in terms of pushing people away from the table when it comes to environmentalism conversations. We've often done that the same way when we're talking about COVID-19 this past year. And people react to situations like the COVID-19 pandemic in very different ways. You feel like you're out of control with your life. You sometimes try to take that control back in different ways. And I think a lot of times in the past year, I've seen a lot of people try to take that control back by saying, I don't want to be vaccinated. I don't want to wear masks. I don't want to take certain restrictions. And it's very easy for someone in public health to be so confused by that. I don't want to wear a mask. I'm not going to help my society. I don't want to social distance because I don't want to take care of my neighbors. And it's very easy to demonize people like that. But when you dig deeper, when you look at why are people reacting this way? Why are people so averse to taking steps to ensure that we stop this pandemic? You start realizing that humans are very complex beings and they have very, very important needs. The needs to see people, the needs to socialize, the need to be in the presence of others. And sometimes something like social distancing, it's very painful. It's almost like a physical pain for some people. The way we could have reacted to the pandemic could have been with a lot more empathy. And I feel like if we had done that, maybe we would have brought more people on board with a lot of the restrictions that were in place. And maybe if we had done that, we would have slowed the pandemic down a little better. But sadly, what I kept on seeing, not just in social media spaces, but sometimes in very real world spaces, is we just wanted to dismiss people who couldn't deal with the realities of the pandemic. And I think that if we had done a better job of bringing them to the table, trying to figure out, dismantle why they're so averse to these restrictions, I think we could have found a lot more support from those people and maybe done a lot better with controlling the pandemic.
Hari Venkatachalam brings his whole self to the climate conversation, including his faith.
People who, when they talk about faith, it's a very visceral and emotional place that they speak from. If we could tap into that and use that as the power to move an environmental movement, to develop green industries. It's just amazing what we could do. And a lot of times I think people are very dismissive of faith because it's often used to fuel not the best of goals, right? That's something that I will freely admit as a religious person, as a person of faith. People even in my own faith sometimes use their faith to fuel movements that aren't the best use of their time. It's not the best way to act as a human being. But if we could use that same gas pedal and apply it to something that's really good, I hate using the word good, but I'm at a loss of a different word. Something that's empowering, something that's a catalyst to create a better future. If we could use that faith to do something like that, just imagine, we would get so many people on our side. Change would happen so quickly because people, when it comes to faith, when it comes to religion, they have such emotion, they have such an investment into that. It's a great tool that just isn't used enough.
Hadi shared with me some of the timeless values and teachings his father taught him, teachings he learned as a Hindu. If you are a person of faith or not, I expect you will draw wisdom and insight from what Hadi has learned so far.
One of the values that I very much associated with was the concept of Svadharma. Svadharma means the dharma or the responsibility that is associated with you and only you. It's not anyone else's dharma, but your own dharma. Every svadharma, every person's dharma is unique, which means that when you do work like environmentalism, it might mean entirely different things to me as a lay individual going about doing my job every day versus someone who's a politician, right? Their svadharma is a little bit different. What they can do, what they can accomplish, what their responsibility is to the environment is very different. I've always taken that concept of Swadharma very seriously. I have been given this path that I need to do certain work. What does that mean for me? Where am I going to apply myself? Where am I going to do that work in terms of environmentalism? Where am I going to do that work in terms of LGBTQ+ issues? And I'm never putting that expectation on someone else. That is my own dharma. That is my svadharma. And I let each person figure out what their own svadharma is. But I think we're all reaching for that same goal. And that's actually what we know in Hinduism as Rita, that there is a universal dharma protecting our planet, doing good for the world, doing good for others. And each svadharma is like kind of a river that flows towards that rita, that entire dharma that our world is part of.
You can learn more about Hadi Venkatachalam and read some of his essays at sadhana.org. That is spelled S-A-D-H-A-N-A, sadhana.org. Now it is time for the Art House. I'm pleased to announce a new semi-regular feature to our show, the Ultimate Cli-Fi Book Club with Krista Heiser. These will not be traditional reviews of climate fiction. Instead, Krista takes a deeper dive and allows her imagination to run wild. In doing so, she creates audio essays that get to the heart of what many climate advocates like me and you are thinking and feeling. Krista also shows us the important role literature plays for humans in a climate-changed world.
Hi, I'm Krista Heiser. I'm just an English professor obsessed with climate change. I'm the host of the Ultimate Cli-Fi Book Club, where we think about how to read and teach and talk about climate-themed literature in order to shift and deepen our conversations about the climate crisis. In this episode, we'll be discussing Blaze Island by Canadian writer Catherine Bush. The 800 scientists and scholars who contributed to the 4,000-page IPCC report told us what we already know in the gut. We're in deep planetary peril. It must be addressed with both fast mitigation and long adaptation. This is the deep paradox of climate change. It's already baked in, and yet everything matters. The scientists and scholars who write the IPCC reports, they swim in the water, the acidic and too hot water of the climate crisis all day, every day, probably in their dreams and nightmares too. I've met several IPCC contributors and I've been surprised to find that they're normal people. And guess what? They make time for reading fiction. Think about it. Any solution or climate action is going to begin with a thought. Like planting trees, or going vegan, or starting a school strike, or flight shame. All actions begin with thought, and fiction stimulates thoughts. This is what I tell myself when I lie in the hammock, obsessively reading cli-fi novels. I read a recent piece in The Economist titled, "Geoengineering is Conspicuously Absent from the IPCC Report," and it had this eerie but so true subhead. It that cannot be named. Geoengineering is a touchy issue among scientists and authors of the reports. Some feel it's so ethically complex and potentially dangerous that it shouldn't even be discussed. Others feel that the role of the reports is to neutrally evaluate all solutions and models. Geoengineering is already on the table, and in fact, it's already occurring, like a massive tree planting. At the scale it would take, for example, for Shell to be net zero, or for all air travel to be carbon offset, is really a type of geoengineering, depending on how you define it. We seem to have engineered our way into this problem with concrete and combustion. So, can we engineer our way out? Or do we need to go with that notion attributed to Einstein that we can't solve problems using the same kind of thinking we used when we created them? I thought this would be a great question to convene a panel around. But check it out. It's an imaginary panel of imaginary climate scientists that's being held in my mind. Here's who's invited. Dr. Milan Wells, the meteorologist from Blaze Island. Dr. Sandra Birdswell, the climatologist from A Rain of Nightbirds. Ovid Byron, the entomologist from Flight Behavior. Patricia Westerford, a dendrologist from The Overstory. And Franny Lynch, the ornithologist from Migrations. And of course, I'm really hoping the panel will be moderated by Mary Robertson, the director of the Ministry for the Future from The Ministry for the Future by Kim Stanley Robinson. Dr. Milan Wells was the first to get back to me. He was one of the early climate researchers pushing to tell the truth which is now unequivocal according to the IPCC. Do you remember ClimateGate? He was one of the scientists threatened back then by climate deniers, and he's been trying to keep a low profile ever since, raising his daughter in the sheltered environment of Blaze Island. Now, the setting in the book is actually a fictionalized version of Fogo Island off the coast of Newfoundland, and the name is intended to evoke both its topology and the climatology theme of the novel. Dr. Wells has been quietly doing small studies on small-scale atmospheric effects of aerosol technologies. He's hoping to draw billionaire interest in using this as a last-ditch effort to slow rising temperatures, to extend life for his teenage daughter and her young friend Caleb. Now, after all he's been through, and given the controversial nature of his research, he was understandably reticent to appear on my panel, but he suggested I talk with author Catherine Bush instead. I took him up on the suggestion. I found her to be an engaging and fascinating person. In her essay, Writing the Real, which, by the way, has been selected for inclusion in Best Canadian Essays this year, Catherine said, "As a writer, I no longer feel capable of making art that fails to acknowledge the climate crisis and the existential condition in which we all live." What she means by the real, of course, is the right now. It's like a feedback loop has finally been established from science to literature, and maybe back again. Catherine and I talked about how writers like Amitav Ghosh, Lydia Millett, Dina Metzger, David Abram, they're saying that the modern novel, which used to focus on an individual psyche and this realism of the ordinary, needs to now expand to include an engagement with the real, with the more than human, with climate change. I'll leave you with some more of Catherine's words. She said, "Addressing the climate in fiction is a demand of realism that is placed on us in terms of how we live now and how we write now. We have to find a way as writers. That doesn't mean that every novel or short story or poem has to address it head on or be about the climate crisis, but it has to be part of the real, the world we live in, how we engage with others, human and non-human, and the world does not look the way it did 20 years ago."
That was Krista Heiser with the first installment of a new semi-regular feature called the Ultimate Cli-Fi Book Club. You can see a written version of this essay at her blog, Field Notes, Teaching Climate Change in Higher Education. It's available at medium.com. I will have a link in our show notes for you. If you want to suggest a Cli-Fi book for Krista, email radio@citizensclimate.org. That's radio@citizensclimate.org. Before we end our program, I have some good news to share with you. Our friends at Yale Climate Communications tells us about a new fund that will help get more people talking about climate change.
I'm Dr. Anthony Lizowitz, and this is Climate Connections. Many communities in the U.S. are working to reduce global warming and transition from fossil fuels to clean energy. But some people have been left out of the conversation.
The whole polar bear PR campaign, you know, from many years back, it really didn't resonate with people of color or people in urban areas. And so what I want to be able to do is to start observing equitable and accessible conversations that really make climate digestible for people and clean energy a digestible topic.
That's Leah Hudnall, director of the Ohio Climate Justice Fund. The new fund provides grants for hosting community listening sessions to organizations led by Black, Indigenous, and other people of color. At these events, Ohioans will share their views about climate change, utility costs, air pollution, green jobs, and more.
Many things, I think, are being done without resident voice and resident input. And so this is a fund that is completely invested in receiving that input and documenting it.
She says this information can be used to encourage policymakers to support climate action plans and craft equitable clean energy policies.
We're really excited to see what happens.
Climate Connections is produced by the Yale Center for Environmental Communication. To hear more stories like this, visit climateconnections.org. If you have a good news story you want to share on our show, email me, radio@citizensclimate.org. That's radio@citizensclimate.org. Here at Citizens Climate Education, we have a solution that will greatly reduce pollution, which leads to climate change. We believe that putting a price on carbon will make a huge difference, and we want to tell you more about it. Visit cclusa.org/price on carbon. That's cclusa.org/price on carbon. Citizens Climate Radio is written and produced by me, Peterson Toscano. Other technical support comes from Ricky Bradley and Brett Cease. Social media assistance from Ashley Hunt Mortarano, Flannery Winchester, and Steve Volk. Moral support from Madeline Pera. You can find Citizens Climate Radio wherever you listen to podcasts, and you can also listen at northernspiritradio.org. Visit citizensclimatelobby.org/blog. There you will see our show notes and find links to our guests. That's citizensclimatelobby.org/blog. Citizens Climate Radio is a project of Citizens Climate Education.